They live by night. They hide in the dark and rise from the shadows. They can never feel the warmth of living human blood in their veins. Their bodies are cold and dead. Dracula versus Frankenstein. Controls the doctor and the living creature horribly created from the mangled corpses of their victims. Dracula versus Frankenstein. His blood is cold, but his mind is keen. He cannot die, for he is already dead. His name is Dracula. Another lives, but his body belongs to the dead. The two will join forces, but only one will survive. Dracula versus Frankenstein. Oakmoor Cemetery is a cold, lifeless place to visit at night. Unless you're already dead, and your name is Dracula.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No, I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price, welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books, and especially Forgotten Horrors Volume 5, The Atom Age, by John Woolley, Jan Allen Henderson, and yours truly. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be necessary. Possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
Thank you. And here's the only writer I know who is certified to perpetuate both existentialism and cop and donut jokes, especially in his famed and acclaimed Comics from the Gone World series, my co-host, Michael H. Price. Michael, how are you?
Hey, what a racket, isn't it?
I'll tell you what. I think the statute of limitations has run out on both of us. I don't think it'll ever catch us.
Well, we've been fooled before, but we always sneak back.
That's right. Well, tonight or today or whenever people happen to be listening to this, we're talking about Al Adamson's greatest hit, I guess you would say, unless you count Satan's Sadists.
I've got a soft spot for Blood of Dracula's Castle.
Yes, and I don't blame you there, you know, and that's the one that he got completely rooked out of, never made a dime out of it, because of that cross-collateralization thing. That was released through, Crown International, I guess, and cross-collateralized with Nightmare and Wax, and there was some sort of devious thing where somebody came in and bought the negatives, as I understand it, and released the two together, and Al never saw anything out of it.
That's pretty much the way Al told it to me in 1993 on his last shoot.
And that, what was he? Was he shooting the Aurora encounter, or the UFO thing at that time?
It was called Beyond This Earth.
Beyond This Earth. That's right.
It was. And the shoot took place at the legendary Aurora, Texas cemetery.
Where allegedly, was there not allegedly an alien had gone down somewhere around there?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. That's what Johnny Simons and I based our Hip Pocket Theater play on, Aurora Ephemerala.
Ah, okay.
About 10, 12 years ago. And it never runs out. It was a strange shoot, but Al was delightful, and I didn't know quite what to make of the encounter. It was something that a mutual friend named Tom Rinone had arranged.
Sure, yes.
Tom was helping out ADing on the shoot. The film, incidentally, never was finished that I know of, and I don't know if Sam Sherman will ever do anything with the negative. But I didn't know what to expect from Al Adamson, because I had George Turner and I had pretty much ranked on him for exploiting the lapsed artistry of Lon Chaney Jr. and
J. Carroll Nash
on that very film, Dracula versus Frankenstein, and
right.
he brought the topic up right well. Just, you know, was, oh, you're the guy that said, yes, sirree. And he says, well, you know, says, we were trying to show some appreciation for those guys. And then he got a little indignant and said, it's not our fault that we weren't capable of giving them what they deserved.
That's right. Which brings me in mind of a story I did on you for the Tulsa World when one of your albums came out, when I was working the Tulsa World, and it had the great, they used a pull quote out of the interview I did with you, and it was, I've always loved the classics. I've just never been able to do them justice. And that may be exactly the same thing you're talking about with Al. And see,
we're
I talk
all in the same boat.
There's yes,
only
we are.
One show business.
That's right. And I talked to Al a few months later, actually a few months before that, but the interview was published a few months later,
yeah.
In Fangoria. And he told me, I went back and found my old Fangoria story, and he said he was talking about the film, the Beyond This Earth, and he said, I think it'll be going to television mostly, but we've got some extraordinary footage of real UFOs, sightings that are unbelievable. We also went to Aurora, Texas to do a sequence, and there's supposed to be an alien buried there. We've been trying to get permission to dig it up. If we could actually do that and show a real alien or get something special, then we might go theatrical. Do you know how far they got on digging any aliens up down there?
He talked about an attempt to garner permissions, but it was all who's got the authority over that patch of desolate ground anyway?
Right.
I think he ran into some petty Hicktown bureaucracy, and needless to say, there was no excavation.
Well, around that same time, Stevie Ashlock, who was his girlfriend at the time, was also in the film.
Yep.
She had family up around the Grand Lake area, Grand Lake of the Cherokees in Oklahoma, which is very close to Tulsa. And she knew through, I believe, Tim Ferrante, who was working with Independent International at the time, that I was working for the Tulsa World. And so she showed up in the newsroom trailing this kind of diaphanous gown and had this footage from the movie that she showed me, and we ended up doing a story on that. And I think it was only a few months later, honestly, that Al Adamson was found murdered in Indio, California.
Yeah.
And so let's talk about Dracula versus Frankenstein. And I've heard two different things, and I'd like maybe for you to perhaps clarify some of it. I have heard in one place, and maybe it's IMDb, but it's other places as well, that it was actually supposed to be started out as a sequel to Satan's Sadists, which is why Russ Tamblyn and the boys, actually there's only a couple of the boys, I think Graydon Clark is one of them, in the movie. And then I've also read that it started out as a thing called the Bloodseekers. Do you know the genesis of Dracula versus Frankenstein?
As with all the Adamson films, this one started out as something else and kept changing. Al didn't simply revise. He butchered as he went along.
Right.
Did genre switches right in the middle of course. And I think the strange beauty of his films is that I don't think there's a one of them that can be classified as a single type of film.
You know, you're right.
You go back and look at his westerns, his science fiction films, his his mad doctor films. They all started out as something else. Then the money would run out. They'd say, well, maybe we need to go this direction. But they would keep what they had.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a splendid, very likable personality.
He did, yes.
Good at schmoozing.
Mm-hmm.
Good at persuading people to squander their artistry on his films. And I don't know that I never spoke with John Carradine about Adamson, but I know that Carradine wouldn't have come back if he hadn't liked the experience.
No, he did a ton of films with Al, didn't he?
Not this particular one, but certainly a good number of them. Al had, of course, he was descended from Victor Adamson, who was a raggedy, independent, shirt-sleeves filmmaker from New Zealand in the 20s.
A lot of people knew as Denver Dixon and Art Mix. Was it Art Mix that he was?
Yes, Art Mix, a name coined to try to exploit the name of Tom Mix.
Sure.
And Al grew up learning that. You know, I mean, you go back to a Victor Adamson film like The Rawhide Terror, and knowing what we know today, thanks mostly to Sam Sherman, you recognize that, why is this film so choppy? Well, Victor started out shooting it as a weekly chapter serial, ran out of money, patched them all together, didn't have money for retakes. That's why certain characters refer to certain other characters by different names during the course of the story.
We should mention that Sam Sherman was a partner with Al Adamson in Independent International Pictures, along with Dan Kinnis was the third guy in that, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And they made some extraordinarily entertaining I refuse to use the idiotic term bad film.
Yes, I do too.
But that, if one were to use that categorization, I suppose that might work. Sam, you know, started out as a genre historian.
Mm-hmm.
Adamson started out as a protege to his raggedy independent filmmaking daddy.
Mm-hmm.
They had extraordinary talents to pool, and as Al probably would say, it's not our fault we couldn't do as good as we wanted.
Right, right. I remember asking him in the interview, were there any films that he would go back and do differently? He said, yeah, all of them.
All of them, yeah.
And that's,
But, you know, I mean, he delivered panoramic widescreen epics that somehow look like anti-epics.
Yeah, and I think maybe, Michael, instead of calling them bad films, which I agree, that's just the terminology is not
anything like guilty pleasure. It's a cowardly way of criticizing a movie.
I think you could call them cheap films.
Very cheap. Very cheap. Very adventurous and willing to take risks that no major studio of the day, and probably not even today, would even think about approaching, although the major studios since, 1975, perhaps, have stolen riff after riff off guys like Adamson and Sherman.
Absolutely, absolutely, and just pumped them up with a lot of money, as we've often talked about, and you and I have written about before.
Oh, yeah.
Pumped them up with star power and money. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's the same picture. Now, on the other hand, I would say that Dracula versus Frankenstein, in some ways, and I watched it about three times. It wasn't a guilty pleasure. It was just a pleasure. I watched it about three times before to prepare for our talking about it. And
yep.
it's very much in the spirit of those monster rallies of Universal in the 40s when they were adding more and more monsters.
Very much. And what to guys like Chaney Jr. and J. Carroll Nash, it wasn't so much as a return to the glory days as it was just a payday.
They were working, yeah.
They were working actors. Chaney knew where he had come from. Nash knew where he had come from. Two of the more accomplished presences of the 1940s,
mm-hmm.
especially the 40s.
Mm-hmm. Especially, yeah.
Nash could play any ethnicity. He was Irish, but he could play Italianate characters, Latinate characters, Yiddish characters, of course his own Irishness. He could play ape men with the best of them.
Mm-hmm.
Chaney had basically one role that he played consistently, but he did it with style and grace.
Yes, he did. And this, yeah, some of this in Dracula versus Frankenstein is obviously meant to evoke Lenny from Of Mice and Men.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, a couple of things, Michael, in this that a lot of people have just sort of taken for fact about Dracula versus Frankenstein, because a lot of things have sprung up around this picture. The picture is enduring. It still plays. And but one of the things was that J. Carroll Nash was in a wheelchair because he was confined to a wheelchair.
Yes,
and that's not true. He was ambulatory.
He was in the role. Exactly.
Yes. And the other thing is that Lon Chaney Jr.'s voice, Lon Chaney Jr. was a mute character because he'd lost his voice to cancer. His voice was very raspy, but he was still speaking at that time. He could speak at that time.
Not long before he died, I caught Chaney on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Yes.
And he was commenting about the rasp in his voice.
Yes, and about how he was, as I recall, I saw that same thing. As I recall, he was talking about scaring the kids on Halloween, wasn't he?
Doing his Wolfman.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And, you know, people say it's sad to see him, but we lose sight of the fact that it was a payday. They were working. They were actors. And as Clue Gulager said to me many years ago, actors act. That's what they have to do.
No turning back.
No.
There's no turning back at all. And much as you may cringe at seeing the faded glory, you're still seeing some glory.
You are still seeing some glory, and even though J. Carroll Nash's dentures are clicking, which is a problem throughout the picture, and also that he's reading, he only had one good eye, and he's reading those giant cue cards, sort of like John Carradine did in Revenge, mm-hmm. when we talked about that before.
And Peggy Sue got married.
And Peggy Sue got married. And you can see that one eye just sort of scanning back and forth in several scenes if you really look for it.
Lends a weirdness.
It does. But given all that, you know, we should probably say for those who haven't seen it, and it's pretty readily available, but it's kind of hard to describe, but essentially J. Carroll Nash is the last descendant of the Frankenstein clan, who for some kind of inexplicable reason has a house of horrors on the Venice Pier.
Well, that's to accommodate the beach party element.
Right, and that's exactly what I wanted to get into. There are all sorts of elements from other genres in this picture, just as you alluded to. This is not just a horror picture. This is a beach party picture. This is a protest picture. This is a biker picture. There's a lot of genres that are melded together in this.
This is a picture that, let's see, it was in production from, I believe, 1969 through a general release in 71.
That sounds about right, yeah.
It is evocative of mainly the American International beach party, biker gang, protest pictures.
Yes.
The hippie doper pictures.
Mm-hmm.
The latter-day monster rally pictures. And you know, I mean, very, very seldom has anyone bothered to explore the linkage between American International's mainly American International's beach party pictures and the same studio's Edgar Allan Poe pictures.
I think we'll be doing that fairly soon in an upcoming Forgotten Horrors, won't we?
I think there's a lot of and of course there are elements of Bigfoot slapstick comedy in Dracula versus Frankenstein, which hark back to the borscht belt humor and the slapstick that makes the beach party movies so vigorous.
And there's also music. Let's not forget that there's a production number with Regina Carroll, Al Adamson's wife, that is just kind of amazing in many ways. And
it's the mutant offspring of beach party, wild in the streets, wild angels, just any number, and then of course you can't forget the pictures like Comedy of Terrors.
Well, right, and of course, and I even started thinking about things like Psych Out and Ride on Sunset Strip. You know, I mean, it's the same sort of deal.
Yeah.
It was all like it was all youth market exploitation. And, you know, you remember, I was thinking about this the other day. You remember, and I can't think of the cat's last name, Michael. You may remember it. Val was his first name, and he won the famous Monsters of Filmland makeup contest. And he was supposed to be, I believe, in The Raven. And he didn't, for some reason or other, there wasn't a place for him in The Raven, so he ends up in Beach Party as the werewolf in where Tim Curry is shooting pool.
That's right.
And I can't remember the guy's name, but there's that monster crossover that you have with the Beach Party movies, with the teen exploitation movies or the drug exploitation movies, that's all wrapped up. I don't want to call Dracula versus Frankenstein the apotheosis of all this stuff, but there's sure all those elements
definitely
in there.
A distillation. And I the first time I saw Dracula versus Frankenstein was on a double bill at one of my late uncle Grady Wilson's movie theaters. Grady had died by this time, but you know, I had a lifetime pass to those theaters, and I played hooky from the newsroom one day and strolled down to my uncle's old theater and watched that and companion bill called, oh gosh, what was the Dracula, Frankenstein's Bloody Terror.
Paul Naschy film.
Which was a Paul Naschy, a Spanish-made, very ostentatious widescreen, you know, panoramic, cinemascope, cheap.
Yeah.
Werewolf film that used the title of Frankenstein, and it's like, wait a minute, what is this? And of course, Adamson, Sam Sherman had, for the American market, he had wanted to use the title Frankenstein, and so he imposed an animated prologue explaining that a certain degenerate branch of the Frankenstein family had changed its name to Wolfstein. And it's like, okay, this is going to be either really depressing or this is going to be really invigorating. Turned out it was both.
Yes, yes, at the same time. You can hold those two ideas, those two conflicting ideas together. And that's kind of how you look at Dracula versus Frankenstein, which has a lot of different kind of tones, you know. And, of course, they kept going back, and, you know, there were actually two Frankenstein monsters in it. If you look at it, John Bloom is credited as the monster, and then there's something like, I can't remember the credit, but it's like, you know, extra thanks to another person who was Shelley Weiss. Well, the reason for that is because they shot most of the Frankenstein Dracula footage in California, and then they had to shoot some more in New York, and they could not afford to bring John Bloom to New York, so they got another guy to play the Frankenstein monster.
No, now, it's amazing.
Al Adamson, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Not to mention that the makeup on that creature looks like John Agar.
Absolutely does. Well, Al Adamson told me when I interviewed him that they had a retrospective of his films in Los Angeles, Satan, Sadist, Dracula versus Frankenstein. And he said the only two people who'd worked for him that showed up were John Bloom and Shelley Weiss.
Wow.
The two guys who had played the Frankenstein monster in Dracula versus Frankenstein. Isn't that strange of all the people? But, you know, you look at the film, and it's got disparate elements, but they all work together, and he's constantly surprising you, too, in this picture.
Never a dull moment.
Oh, my, no.
And then, of course, you know, and then you've got little bonuses like Angelo Rosito.
Yes.
As playing his stereotyped character as the evil dwarf. And
I've read that he relished that part, that he was really happy to play that part.
Now, that's Angelo told me. He said he thought that was going to be his great epic performance until he got Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome,
right,
what, 10 or 12 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Angelo had had a career in the movies that he did not rely on. He ran a little street corner newsstand in Hollywood.
Yeah, I remember Dave Friedman telling us, you know, about going down there and getting a hold of Angelo for, I think, She Freak. So he'd run the newsstand, and people would come by, exploitation filmmakers mostly want to use him in a film, and there he'd go. You know, he had a kind of a sweet gig in a lot of ways.
Oh, yeah, and a lovely fellow. First time I met Angelo, this was back in the 60s, I guess, made the mistake of mentioning Freaks, the Todd Browning film.
Right.
And he kind of rankled at that.
Really? How come, John Michael?
That was exploiting us little people. Mm. Angelo was very militant. He had been a founder of the group known as Little People of America.
Along with Billy Barty, I think, right?
Yeah, along with Billy Barty. And a number, Billy Curtis, and a number of others. Angelo was the first of the little people to make a career in Hollywood. That is, as opposed to being a circus or carnival performer who did a one-shot movie and then went back to the carnival.
I see.
Angelo had devoted himself to becoming a motion picture personality in the early years, and of course Freaks was a good paying gig, but it also kind of grated against his sensibilities. In the intervening years, Angelo mellowed quite a bit, and the last time we visited, shortly before he died, the early 90s, as I recall, he spoke very fondly of those opportunities.
Good. You know, I loved him in Child Bride, frankly. That's my favorite Angelo Rizzuto. He's the hero in Child Bride.
It was his favorite, too, because he got to kill the bad guy.
That's exactly right. He was the hero. He was the guy in the white hat. Well, yeah. We also want to mention, I think, that for those baby boomers who might be listening, that Anthony Eisley is the nominal hero in this picture, although Jim Davis is in it as well. After his Western days, and before he was featured in Dallas, of course. I like Anthony Eisley in this. He's sort of supposed to be a hipster, but I remember him so vividly from Hawaii and I, which is one of those great Warner Brothers hour-long detective things, along with Bourbon Street Beat and 77 Sunset Strip and all of those. Yeah. He was really good in that. He has said in other places this is his least favorite film, but that may be because I don't want to be a spoiler here, that he doesn't quite make it to the end. You know, have you ever thought about that? What happens to him kind of comes out of left field.
And that's another one of those never a dull moment things.
That's right. I mean, that's right.
You can put Adamson right up there with Roger Corman,
yes,
in terms of an ability to keep things moving. There are no lulls.
No. There are no wasted scenes. Now, there are scenes that seem to belong in other films, but there's no wasted scenes, you know. I mean, they all, taken as a whole, they're all right. And Zandor Varkov, we want to mention him, who is a guy, Roger, what was his name? Forey Ackerman allegedly came up with...
Ackerman made that silly-sounding name, Zandor Varkov. Right.
Zandor being from one of the, was that one of the, like, Black Magic guys, wasn't it? Zandor or Varkov was. I've got my notes here, and I'll look at it and be able to tell you here in just a moment. But
Ackerman came up with the silly sounding name. Ackerman also has a cameo.
Yes.
In the film.
Yes.
But Roger Engel, aka Zandor.
Roger Engel, that's his name. Yes. Right.
Was an investor in Independent International.
Wasn't he a realtor as well or something? Was that what his day job was?
My understanding is that he was a broker.
A broker, okay.
But I'm sure he dabbled in real estate. Mm-hmm. He made two movies, both of them for Adamson.
Mm-hmm.
Brain of Blood being the other one, about
yes.
that same time.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hope that wasn't his real hair that sports in the picture. It's like, I wouldn't want to do business with a stockbroker with a haircut like that.
Well, I got to tell you, Michael, there's some wonderful hair in that picture. Yeah, Jim Davis has great hair in it, and of course Regina Carroll has just got the greatest 70s hairstyle of all time in that.
Mm-hmm.
She really sort of had something going. Of course, Al had met her when they were shooting, I believe, Satan's Sadist, or shooting some film, and mm-hmm. they always shot the, you know, I tried to pin him down on how long it took to make Dracula versus Frank. Says, well, the first, we shot for 2 weeks, and it wasn't very good, and then we came back, and, you know, he really sort of glossed over it. But at some point in there, he met Regina Carroll, who was waiting tables at her dad's coffee shop because someone hadn't shown up, and that's how she became Regina Carroll and became the leading lady in most of Al's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
she was, you know, she kind of had something, I think.
Had a very radiant personality.
Yep, and died early, unfortunately. Died pretty young.
In her 40s in 92, about 3 years before Al, and of course he never was the same after that.
No.
But, you don't experience a productive marriage like that. Productive is relative, but they made some accomplishments.
They did,
and he made a star of her within that limited sphere.
Right,
and he was never embarrassed by his pictures. And
no,
that's the when a filmmaker apologizes for something, Alan Rudolph comes to mind,
mm-hmm.
or refuses to acknowledge an early accomplishment.
Oh, like, say, Barn of the Naked Dead?
Barn of the Naked Dead. Yeah, it's like, well, whoever told you I made that picture? You know?
Right. Uh-huh.
but Adamson was very proud of what he had accomplished, and I find that charming, courageous.
I do, too. I do, too. And his films aren't like anybody else's.
Nope.
I mean,
you can't lump him in with the Ed Woods. You can't lump him in with any of the so-called, we won't use the term, but I mean...
bad film people, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Any of the others, there is no single style of perceived ineptitude.
No.
And when you look at, does this film accomplish what it sought to do? Well, probably not. But certainly Adamson gave it everything he had, which was in a purely academic, empirical sense, which was not enough. But in a personal, inventive sense, it was more than plenty.
Well, it brings to mind what one of Ed Wood's friends said after he died and after... our number one fundamentalist movie critic Michael Medved did with 50 Worst Films of All Time and Golden Turkey Awards and all of that. Someone asked one of Ed Wood's friends, what he would have thought about all of this attention, being the worst director of all time, worst film of all time, and the fellow said, well, I think he would have said, well, at least I did it, damn it. What have you done?
Yeah.
And I feel the same way about, I identify, I guess, anybody who's struggled to get some sort of a vision across as a writer, as a musician, as a filmmaker, as an actor, I think can identify with the folks who are doing the best that they can.
Body of work, man. That's body of work there.
Absolutely.
And it's more than just amusing. It's very instructive to go back and watch these pictures and see what determination will get you. I've known many accomplished filmmakers who have made like some really boring movies.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
If I want to see a bad film, I'll kick back and watch Out of Africa.
That's exactly right. I'd far rather see, you know, if Out of Africa is on one channel and Killer Shrews is on the other, I know where I'm going. You know, but you can see there's a new network. I don't know how new it is, but it's new to me, Comet, which is one of those networks, one of those HD networks that's playing science fiction and horror pictures. And they showed Dracula versus Frankenstein the other day and free TV, you know, over-the-air TV.
Yeah.
And so the film, all these years later, continues And I think it's something to be said for Al and that whole bunch of threadbare folks getting in there and doing the best that they could and putting something together that people would enjoy to drive in, you know?
Yep.
And that's the approach I think that you've got to take with Dracula versus Frankenstein. It's not a great film by any stretch of the imagination, but it's sure an entertaining film.
Oh, a hell of a fun film.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And nice to see all those faces.
Yeah.
Just like given pretty much free rein.
I
watched Adamson direct. He really did not. He was more of the traffic cop
mm-hmm,
type.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he wouldn't dictate line readings. He
mm-hmm.
wouldn't. He wouldn't bully his actors. He wouldn't mollycoddle his actors. He was just okay.
Mm-hmm.
That works.
Mm-hmm.
Cut.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Let's go with the next setup, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
All right. Well, that's Dracula versus Frankenstein, and now we come to the part of the evening or the part of the podcast where we want to talk about what's going on. What do you got coming out, Michael?
Well, of course, we are working together on Forgotten Horrors Volume 9.
That's right. That's right.
I have determined that there will now be a Forgotten Horrors Volume 10.
Good.
Mainly consisting of pieces that I've published over the years that have never been collected elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that includes a whole lot of magazine columns, a long run of columns for Mike Gold's publishing company. And it's going to veer pretty much far afield from the known territory, and a lot of general pop culture interest type things.
Good.
And so that's falling together from found objects in the files. We just went to press yesterday on the first anthology of my newspaper columns.
Good.
And that'll cover the more recent years, mainly because they were digitally archived, where all the early stuff is on floppy disks
right.
and line printouts.
Right. Good. So that's coming up. And how about the comics from the Gone World series?
That is proceeding apace. I'm not sure what's going to be next, because there are five individual collections in preparation.
Well, you got the Necronomicon going, which is really interests me.
I thought a little Lovecraft parody might come in handy. This
mm-hmm.
one is called the Velcronomicon.
Right.
And it's quite silly.
What a surprise.
But consistent with the model.
Right.
And so I have no idea where this is going. You get an idea, you commit to it, and then you jump in and start flailing about in hopes that something will happen.
Absolutely.
And it usually does.
Absolutely. I'm with you. And I want to remind folks that I've got the Homicide Highball script out right now. That's the Dan Turner Hollywood Detective movie script that's never been seen before, that was set in the 1980s. At one time, Ray Parker Jr. was supposed to be our Dan Turner, and we were going to take this 40s character and put him in the 80s and see what happened, and I wrote the script that way. And then by that time, Freeze Entertainment came along and said, no, we want it back in the 40s. So the folks at Bold Venture Press down in Florida have printed this book, have put this book out, and I've got the original story that Robert Leslie Bellum wrote about Dan Turner. I've got the script that I wrote off the story, and then I've got a pretty nice introduction in it, and it's all popularly priced. So we appreciate people, everyone who listens to the podcast, at least take a look on Amazon and see what Michael and I have out, and see if perhaps it's something that might be worth your attention.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for listening to the Forgotten Horrors podcast, and we'll be back before you know it. Thank you,
nice.
Michael.
Nice work. Carry on.